Greetings, dear listeners. In today's edition of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan, which will be the final installment of the 23-24 season, I want to explore the current crisis facing the retail ski community in collaboration with today's guest, Gary Fleming, the newly anointed president of Winter Sports Retailers, an organization that represents 118 specialty retailers comprising over 300 locations in the U.S. Before I provide a quick sketch of Mr. Fleming's eminent qualifications, permit me to introduce MasterFit Enterprises as the title sponsor for Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. As I've often touted in my weekly revelations, MasterFit conducts the most thorough boot fit training sessions in the world, as well as orchestrating the world's most comprehensive boot testing program. Compared to the information available at bootfitters.com, all other attempts at boot reviews are a joke. MasterFit also provides a complete line of off-the-rack insoles that provide an affordable upgrade from the all-but-worthless stock shims that come with one's boots, and one of the best custom insole systems extant. We wholeheartedly endorse the entire MasterFit program and are eternally grateful for their support. Now about today's guest. On March 5th, 2024, barely a month ago, Gary Fleming was named president of the newly formed organization Winter Sports Retailers, comprised of the members of two previously competing ski specialty shop retail consortia, Sports Merchandising Corporation, known as SMC, and Sports Specialist Limited, or SSL. This matters to you, dear listener, because this matrix of some 300 local ski shops represents the best of what we have left for qualified ski shops in America. To put that number in perspective, when I was forecasting units for Salomon back in the 1980s, we imagined the retail community extended to at least 3,200 outlets, and that didn't include rental-only operations. I hasten to point out that the relatively feeble 300 number doesn't include every shop in the country, only those who are WSR members. As a reference, Jackson's list recommends 304 locations. Lest we get lost in the numbers, let's just say that specialty retailers who are dedicated to their craft are dwindling in number. It's fair to assert that the membership of WSR is at the very least a bellwether slice of the market. Gary Fleming therefore occupies a unique seat in the American ski pantheon with an unobstructed view of what's going on at the granular level. We're going to ask Gary about when the seeds were planted that sprouted this spring into panic budget cutting on the part of equipment suppliers. Many gear vendors introduced new models with the expectations that orders would go up. Instead, they went the other way. We'll soon delve into the nitty-gritty of current market conditions, so don't touch that dial. In the interest of full disclosure, my dear listeners should know that I've known Gary Fleming for decades. He assumed my seat as the marketing director at Head Winter Sports in 2002 and later guided the fortunes of Elan in this country when I was peddling Desperate Measures and later Real Skiers. He also happens to be Canadian, our second on Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. So he's tuned into that market in ways most American brand managers are not. It gives me great personal as well as professional pleasure to introduce my guest this week, Gary Fleming. Welcome to Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan.
Well, thank you, Jackson. I appreciate you inviting me here. We do go back a long way. I remember starting at Salomon in 1986 and hearing about this guy who did these crazy presentations and had to change clothes twice a day because he was so into it. And that was my first, not sighting, I guess, is hearing of you, Jackson. I had also the pleasure of following up something you started at Head back in the early 2000s.
That's quite true. I'd like to open our chat today with a sketch of your origins as a skier. How old were you when you first stepped into a pair of skis, and where did this blessed event occur?
It started a little later in life. I lived in a city in Montreal, and my dad decided that he wanted to live in the country and moved us up to this little town called Saint-Sever. And we had seven ski areas within 10 minutes of our house, nothing over 750 feet. But I quickly got into skiing and had some serious catch up to do with my friends having started at 3 or 4 years old. It was something fantastic that really set me on a path. I was teaching skiing by 16, working in a ski shop through college, never thinking I'd go into the ski industry, but it just became part of life.
When you say you worked at a ski shop, what ski shop did you work at?
It was what I would call one of the great all-time ski shops was called the Trading Post. It was a shop that was around for a long time, owned by a gentleman named David Bryson. We would have the customers come in, usually had to have a waiting list, but we would send them straight to the boot room. They would come up to the ski room and then off to the apparel. At that time, I wasn't even thinking I was selling stuff because everybody that walked in was buying stuff. So it was a really a great specialty shop.
So that got you started in the ski world, in the ski trade. How did your career go from there to when you, where is your first manufacturer or supplier side responsibility?
Well, I came out of college, applied at the phone company, the electric company, and a ski company. And luckily, I got a job with Salomon as a customer service representative. And it was definitely the best thing that could have happened to me. And I ended up going from customer service to tech rep to sales rep to director of marketing in Canada. I was lucky enough to have a couple of guys that I would never have predicted that helped me through all these steps and put up with all the dumb things you do when you're in your 20s. Robert Langlois, who hired me, promoted me, and later in the U.S., I worked with him again at Head. And another fellow named Pierre Marcoux, two guys from Quebec City, took this English Montrealer and really helped me along my way.
Dear listeners, Robert Langlois is probably not a name known to you, but he was one of the most delightful bon vivants and just general rascal I've ever had to deal with. We in the U.S. were supposed to be somewhat overseeing what was going on at the Canadian subsidiary. And I went up and did a dealer tour with Robert through the heart of Quebec, French-speaking, of course, had some of the best meals of my life, and also got to observe close-hand a violation of just about every agreement we'd ever signed at Salomon about how you were supposed to conduct business. Special deals, rebates, kickbacks, all in the U.S. would have gotten you fired the next day. Under Robert Langlois's absolute ownership of Quebec. No one was going to argue with Robert, by the way, because he had like 60% market shares throughout the province. I mean, his and his family, the Quebec mafia, had an enormous amount of market control over a very busy market. Quebec was a fiercely competitive and well-populated market with ski shops.
It certainly was. Quebec... Typically, Canada is a third Quebec, a third Ontario, and a third of the rest of the country. And Quebec's kind of a unique place, a little more European-like, but there's just ski areas everywhere.
Jumping ahead, when you joined Head after I left, tell me a little bit about your highlights when you were there. When I was at Head, it was still sort of struggling to shake off the burden of having had a recall of their Tyrolia binding part of their corporate puzzle, and the U.S. dealer network took a long, long time to forgive Head for that debacle. But you were part of that. What I would say was Head on the coming up on the rebound. You had a star athlete in Yoon Olsen. Head was introducing its first piezoelectric entry into the vibration absorption game, which is still with us, by the way. They're still using piezoelectric technology in a lot of their skis, particularly their carving skis. Tell us a little bit about your early career at Head and what sort of stuck with you from that period.
Well, I think when I joined Head, it was very, very different than Salomon, where Salomon, you learned what the story was and you practiced that story and you went out and acted on it. And at Head, they did not have the kind of backup product management, marketing management. And subsequently, the brand in the U.S. meant very different things in very different territories. You know, if you had a rep that was a racing guy, so the Pacific Northwest might have been a racing brand that Head was, whereas in Colorado it might have been a free ride brand. And luckily I followed you, and I think you started the story, the real story of Head and what they stood for. Now Head is very strong everywhere else in the world, but in the U.S. it had been languishing, and no really rallying story. The guys in Austria knew they made great skis and they didn't quite know why they should have to tell anybody about it. And so
exactly a marketing driven company, that's for sure.
No, it was definitely kind of the opposite of Salomon. It was really about the manufacturing. The piezoelectric or head intelligence was really the first rallying story for Head and allowed us to speak in a more focused way about the brand and about the products. And around that time, they started really getting into the ski boots and started doing well there with Edge ski boots, something simple. It was very effective and started becoming slowly climbing up the ladder from a C brand to a B brand and headed towards an A brand, which it was in other countries.
So eventually your tenure at Head runs out, as it did for everybody at one point in time. Everyone marched at the guillotine at Head eventually. And then you did a brief interlude with the world of backcountry and Nordic. You went on to Oslo and Lowe for a period of time?
Yeah, it was in the outdoor industry. It was very, very different than ski. And I was sort of trying to pioneer a great American brand that was very similar to Head, started by American Jeff Lowe. It was Lowe Alpine. Like Head, people have forgotten that it was an American that started the brand and had a tremendous story behind it. And in fact, while at Head, we started retelling the story through some of our clinics. I think Howard Head started the company with poker winnings from a train trip from Maryland to Vermont. And so there was some really interesting stuff in it. At Lowe Alpine, it was the same, but it was a company that really did have a different personality in every country where it existed. And in the end, I sort of yearned back for the ski industry. The Elan opportunity in the U.S. Came up.
The Elan opportunity in the U.S. was to run the Elan subsidiary. Let's talk about that a little bit, because Elan sort of bursts on the U.S. scene, as far as our memory of the brand, with the SCX and the carving ski revolution, at which they were in the very front row holding the highest standard up, saying, you know, just about we invented this whole genre. And they had phenomenal success. I think you mentioned a staggering figure of what they sold in just 1 year. What was that number of SCXs that went out the door 1 year?
One of the former heads of Elan in the in the 80s stopped by my office once and showed me a sales report where they had sold 160,000 pairs of SCX skis.
Holy moly, ladies and gentlemen, that is a huge number for any one brand today, certainly for any one model. And yet they managed to fritter that whole advantage away. It wasn't probably 10 years later, they were almost an afterthought even within the carving pantheon and sort of slunk back down into a level below what you might call the major brands in the U.S. market. How did the air get out of the balloon?
I mean, I think at Elan, they have been part of their culture. They're fearless innovators, and they can make a dollar go further than most. But there was always a money issue with Elan. Ownership over the years was state-owned, and they were never able to capitalize. And in the end, the SCX was a little more extreme than most. I remember the K24 coming in, the Head Cyber coming in, and they were maybe even a little more skiable, but the subsidiaries were relatively small. They really did some unbelievable groundwork. A gentleman named Bill Irwin, I think he knows every skier in the United States, went out and actually taught people how to use these skis. But once they got that through, and they did a heck of a job, because I remember being at Salomon and having the top ski the year that the Shape skis came in, the ProLink, it won every award. And by November, we could not give it away because it wasn't a Shape ski. They did a heck of a job just putting this on the map. And unbelievable, actually, for the size of the company. But in the end, the money to back it up, once the other manufacturers really gave in to it, it made it just tougher and tougher for Elan. And they slowly but surely went back to being known more for rental and kid stuff, not really having the best mix skis being sold.
Two big trends came out of the 90s, one of which was shape skis and carving. And the other trend going in a different direction was fat skis. And I would contend it is fat skis which ultimately succeeded in this war between these two branches of the ski market and became what Americans would crave and would want in lieu of getting a tight-waisted carving ski. And that was a particular train that Elan never caught up with. Why did they sort of miss getting on the fat ski bus?
Well, very much like a lot of the old-time manufacturers like Head, these were not skis they thought were skis. So initially, they tried to make skis wider that could carve. It took them a long time to get onto the notion that it was okay to slip or slide. And, you know, the first ones were so stiff. And we fought so hard to get them. And of course, we'd only sell 50 pairs. And so they'd roll their eyes at us. And it took a long time. I mean, you look at some of the companies and the way they see things. Salomon, for example, they probably lasted with rear entry boots 5 years too long. And it just takes time for some of these companies to get with the program. The Europeans will come visit here, but they're not living here. And they were not getting what people were looking for.
You also didn't have a terrifically stable ownership picture at Elan when you were there compared to Salomon, which had a consistent, you know, management team. Didn't you? Didn't the Elan, the picture around you change while you were there?
Oh, it changed significantly. They, as I said, it was state-owned. And when they joined the EU, there was big pressure to privatize the companies. But it was very difficult to sell. And I think we went through two ownership changes while I was there. So that stability wasn't there. But the second level of management was strong. And they managed to, as I said, stretch a dollar more than most, let's say.
Eventually, you leave the manufacturing side of our business and join the buying group SMC, which has now folded into with SSL into WSR. Pardon for the acronyms, folks, but that's the acronyms for the consortia of U.S. specialty shops. A very, very significant chunk of the U.S. market. That significance has only grown over the years as the rest of the market has shrunk. From your perch now at the top of WSR, what would you say is the percentage of specialty shop sales that you think passes through your membership's portals? Sort of give us an idea of what you're doing and what the context is in which you're doing it, if you will.
We think that we are now that we're joined, we'll have about 350 outlets in 118 businesses spread really throughout the U.S. in 33 states. My guess is that we're about a third of the doors out there. And these are, financially at least, the best shops out there. Both groups, before joining, had been running for over 50 years. In the beginning, it was really quite simple. The way they formed is the one guy couldn't get the best discount with Rossignol, and the other guy couldn't get the best discount with Vocal. And so they said, well, I'll buy all the Rossignols and get the best discount, and you buy all the Vocals. And that's how the group started. It was really quite simple. In terms of the volume we have, I believe if we're a third of the doors, we're probably close to a third of the volume.
The reason I'm asking these particular numbers questions, and there's a reason behind this, dear listeners, I'm trying to get a picture of what the U.S. market is, because right now I'd say the U.S. market has very, very poor top-down information about its own composition. But you have a very clear view of roughly a third of the specialty shop market or the retail market in the U.S., which is a very significant slice. So I'm trying to figure out, well, what does the whole look like? And there's the method to my madness, and that is we have a hugely growing number of skier days. We don't have a hugely growing number of skis sold. And I'm trying to figure out where did the skis that we're not selling go to? So to back up then, you've got a certain number of skis you're selling. That's about a third of the market. We extrapolate that out. When we then add in internet sites that don't go through a brick and mortar channel. People like Backcountry or Curated or The Essentials does have a retail location, but they're certainly doing more online than they are at their retail location. You also have the indie market. There's got to be 100 brands in the U.S. that try to sell skis in some way, shape, or form. I suppose most of them probably don't crack the 2,000 unit level, but they're there. What do you think the size of the retail market is that the consumer is looking at from both the internet and brick and mortar and every channel except, let's say, fleet rental? What do you think we're selling every year?
We've gone through a unique couple of years with COVID, for sure. The only real numbers that I trust are the numbers where the manufacturers report what they sold by price point through SIA, the Snow Sports Industry Association. And then they get the totals and they're able to look at their market shares. But those are sell-in numbers. And there's always a lapse between the sell-in and the sell-through. And rental is part of that. And it's a very different business. But before COVID, the U.S. market for, 5 to 7, 8 years was around 600,000 pairs, including rentals, sold into the market. The indies, for the most part, are not reporting. My guess is it's probably 40 or 50,000 pairs of skis that are not being reported. Once COVID hit, after the uncertainty in the ski areas started opening, the subsequent year, the market jumped up to 725,000 pairs. And then in 2022-23, it jumped up to 825,000 pairs, which was very significant.
We had a go, then no go, then go sort of situation happened when COVID first hit. Everyone canceled their orders overnight. It was just after the selling season. It was March, and people had just written orders, which then meant frantic phone calls saying, cancel that order, stop the presses. And then by fall, they were going, fire up the presses. We don't have these. So there was a full-on panic to get product through a restrained delivery pipeline. And then the manufacturers seized the opportunity further to move up their order dates, their deadlines of when the retailers had to give them their numbers, which had been as late as April. And they said, no, we want that early February. And the retailers, confronted with early deadlines and a market that was careening from zero to a million, it seemed like, ordered too much. Don't you think that's somewhat a problem that then lingered for a year before rising to the surface this year?
They did order too much because they were basically scared by the suppliers into, if you don't order it now, you're not going to get it. So everybody ordered, if they thought they needed $100,000 worth of skis, they ordered them all in preseason. And normally they would order 2/3 of that and then reorder the rest based on the season. But they took everything in. And so the numbers in 22-23 were 825,000 pairs, and they were all ordered right up front. They weren't delivered on time, and the suppliers had to play catch up and were shipping. Normally you ship to the stores in August, September, October, but they were shipping right up into February. They were just trying to play catch up. The surprise the suppliers got the following year, when retailers realized there was still a lot of product out there, they went back to ordering 70% upfront. So last year, the retailers forecasted to sell the same amount as the year before, but they ordered only 70% and said the 30% to come during the rest of the year. The suppliers were, I would say, a little delusional, thinking it was just going to continue to go the way it went. Everybody speaks about, well, we have to look at 2018-19 and not compare with 2020-21-22. But that was just talk. Everybody still thought it was going to keep going and going and going. And so the market dropped down to 725,000 pairs, which was still significantly above what it had been pre-COVID. And then we have the normal things that we all live with, is the weather. The East has had a couple of rough years. This year, I'd say the start of the season, I've never seen no snow everywhere. The reorders didn't quite come in. And so my feeling is we're going back to normal. And if we get some good early snow, things will be fine. But there's definitely a lapse between the skier days and the sell-in numbers that we use to measure things. There's at least a year, maybe 2 years behind. You know, when we look at the season's pass sales, things have changed significantly there. If you're skiing more than 5 or 6 days, you're getting a season's pass because economically it just makes more sense. It's a little difficult to tell, but I think now we're back to the normal ski challenges and our snow and weather and cold. And the suppliers are, if they are going back on their marketing dollars, it's just because it was so dramatically higher for 2 years. And I guess everybody just got so excited they thought it was going to stay like that. And it's just coming back to normal.
I think it's the nature of marketeers to be optimistic and to seize upon what they see as an opportunity to grow. And only after a while do they realize that they've skated out onto some pretty thin ice. While we're looking at macro, let's look at a couple of other aspects of the ski market globally and not quite so provincially as looking at the lift service market. The backcountry and the touring and off-trail non-lift service skiing also went through a COVID boom. You're quite familiar with that part of the market, having gotten your feet wet in the outside world. What do you think is going on with the gyrations in that market? Is it also returning to a pre-COVID, more manageable, more realistic number of people? And I say more realistic because going off trail and climbing uphill is hard to climb uphill through new snow. And all the people that bought it weren't necessarily people who were destined to stay in it. But can you roughly speak to how that market ballooned and then shrank again?
Yeah, I may not be the best person because I've always been frustrated with the efforts that the manufacturers make in that market, given how small it actually is. Sometimes you measure things in percentage, but sometimes you measure things in just dollars or units. And it definitely had a big uptick. You never used to see somebody climbing up the hill in the East. And now you do a little bit. But it, as you said, it is hard. And typically, people are really focused on going downhill. So they have to buy a special boot. They have to buy a special binding. But they're buying an alpine ski or using one of their alpine skis because they're really focused on going up. So that makes it even harder because you don't have something lightweight. It's still a relatively small market. I'm not sure where it's going to go or how sustainable it is. I remember back, I guess, in the 90s, Telemark had a little resurgence, but you'd see people on Telemark skis skiing alpine. So the essence of that is you're getting to a place where you couldn't normally get. I'm not sure that's what caused this little boom, because people were doing it at ski areas. So I'm not sure it's going to get any significantly bigger.
One other adjunct to the ski market is the snowboarding market. What do you see what's happened there recently? And is that at a fairly stable level now as a percentage of the total snow sports world?
You know, there was a time where you were 16 years old and you didn't necessarily want to go sideways. But every ski shop you walked into, you couldn't see any clothing you wanted, any graphics that you liked. Then you'd go to a snowboard shop and say, wow, this is me. That's changed. It's no longer skiing is just for old guys. It's stabilized. The growth is now probably similar to skis. And, you know, you have 16-year-olds choosing skiing or snowboarding or doing both together. It's not an us versus them situation anymore. It's been stable. It keeps the same kind of percentage versus skis. We're not expecting a whole lot of change there.
I think that one of the reasons that suppliers for alpine goods were caught flat-footed this year when submitted orders fell well short of their forecasts is that most of them had some hot new models to tout. They were ready to roll out some big changes in their product line. And normally you get a sales boost from that. But instead, they didn't get a bigger order. on which marketing budgets had been based, they got smaller numbers. And this resulted in the manufacturers and the supply line going through a budget crunch panic. And budgets were slashed overnight. Longstanding relationships were suspended without further notice. Heads rolled, heads that sometimes had been on their shoulders for 30 years at a given brand were suddenly given their walking papers. Brands that were already under duress saw their situations get even worse. How do you read the current market conditions? Is this just a blip we're going through? Is everything going to be just fine? It seems like the pain is real in certain quarters. And when you fire people with 30 years of experience, that isn't so easily replaced. Do you see any sort of stutter steps or manufacturers struggling to maintain their, you know, their market position? Quite a few brands that are back out in the financial markets trying to raise money to keep going. How dire do you think the situation is? Or am I just fanning the flames of just a small ember?
I'm sure it's tough for some of the smaller brands. If you have a marketing budget of $1 million that goes down to $500,000, it's hard to do very much, certainly towards the consumer. The problem the ski industry has always had is the marketing dollars are predominantly spent on the trade and not on the consumer. Trade shows and tents and posters and all this kind of stuff. The online presence has made it easier for brands now to reach people. It's not so much through the magazines and advertising through the magazines. The bigger brands are still in a good position. We're still above where we were 4 years ago. And in fact, our groups host a trade show in January, and we intended it just to be for the group members, but it's become somewhat of a national show, Winter Sports Market. And we saved the suppliers well over $100,000 by doing this show, a show that's more conducive to the size of our industry. They're not trying to have a 50 by 50 booth. It's just something that's making sense. And those are big savings for some of these companies. I think
the $100,000 figures, dear listeners, that Gary refers to is per brand. This is not a global savings. Every brand was able to take six figures straight to the bottom line and say, well, there's some money saved.
You know, when I took on this role after 30 years on the supplier side, I was absolutely amazed at how little each side knew about the other. Everybody was tight-lipped. The brands would find out how the year went when they got their orders for the following year and were surprised. You know, some guys, after the preseasons went from everything up front to 70%, the first two suppliers to call me when they got their orders were so disappointed. And I said, well, that's surprising because you two did the best. And so if last year, if you were down 10%, you gained significant market share. So we're trying to work with the suppliers a little more to have less surprises, so that they can plan when they're doing their forecasting. We do business surveys every month, and it shows if the stores are up by region or down, if the inventory is up or down, and we share that so that the suppliers really can plan ahead a little bit. You know, we have all sorts of focus groups with them on product, but we're sharing a lot more information with them so they have less surprises.
The biggest threat to your community that you directly serve now, the specialty retailers of the U.S. marketplace, their biggest threat is the direct-to-consumer sales by their suppliers. Suppliers once did not try to interfere in the same business as their customers. In other words, they weren't trying to sell their wares direct-to-consumer. They let that happen through the retail channel. Now the pressure is increasing on all parties, because most of these corporations are publicly held and they have a duty to their shareholders to try to get maximum value. And maximum value seems to be, if you look at just a certain part of the spreadsheet, to be in the direct consumer market. There was a recent article in SGB Media that cited a 49% increase in direct-to-consumer sales over the previous years at Amer, which owns, among other brands, Arc'teryx, which was given the most of the credit for this increase. And if you looked at the margins that you can make on a direct-to-consumer sale versus the margins you make on a wholesale sale to a retailer, boy, that direct-to-consumer piece of business sure looks mighty attractive. Where do you see this going? It's putting the manufacturer supplier in direct competition with their membership retailers, and in some cases, very aggressively so. Are manufacturers all going to be tarred with the same brush here, or are there going to be brands that are regarded more as, you know, holding the line for the independent retailer? Or is this just market forces winning out, and the market forces are inevitably going to lean or come back to direct-to-consumer sales? Where do you see that today, and where do you see it going tomorrow?
I think the manufacturers have to be online and have their product available. Most consumers think it's just silly if they go look at a website and they can't buy. However, there's a big difference with ski equipment. And also COVID had a big factor where everybody was, you know, your best friend was the UPS guy because he was at your house every day. And the thing is, ski equipment has to end up in a shop. It has to get mounted. It has to get tested. It has to get fit. Just going into the online business or direct-to-consumer business doesn't mean you're going to be successful. And for the most part, they're far behind the Ski Essentials or the Backcountries of the world or Evos of the world in terms of their professionalism, the way they can service the customer. And in the end, the price, I mean, it's very enticing for a supplier all of a sudden to double up their margin. However, they count on the shops' pre-season orders to know how much to bring in. When you're selling direct to consumer, especially when you're starting, you have no clue how many you're going to sell. And sometimes what's happened in the last couple of years is we've had excess inventory because the online sales are not nearly what they thought they would be. But I think the most important thing is, and there are a few suppliers doing this, having partnerships with the retailers, sharing in a sale, arranging for the service, the mounting to be done through the shop, and the shops being compensated for it. Right now, a shop, if you're buying a pair of skis and bindings, the mounting is going to be $25 or nothing. They put it into their price. When you just walk in with a pair of skis, they can't afford to do that. So the charge, and typically what we've seen, and I think online business this year suffered more than brick and mortar business from some of the market info that we've gotten, because the pricing is identical. And in fact, the shops have a little bit more negotiation power than online. So people are often coming in, paying $100 to get their skis mounted, realizing the price of the skis was the same. And frankly speaking, as good as some of these online websites are, and some are very good, lots of information, when you're talking to somebody and you see somebody, you can size up what they need more effectively than just doing something online. They're going to end up in the shop.
The key to the specialist survival is making sure that they still incentivize the consumer to come to the shop. And the things that are driving the consumer to the shop is that skiing is a service-intensive sport. You need someone to mount your bindings for you. That's not something you want to say, oh, I think I can handle that myself. No, you can't. I think I want to tune my skis myself. You cannot duplicate what a $400,000 tuning machine can do with your little file. I would say that, and this is an age-old mantra, but the key to the success of the specialty retailer has to be service. And understand you have to do as good a job promoting your service as the price people do of promoting their price. Would you say that's fair?
I think that's fair. And I think the pricing, you know, it's always about the price. Everybody wants to get a deal. But the deals are not better in one place or the other. And in fact, when you're speaking to somebody in a ski shop, they'll have more negotiation power than you will have when you're just online. So it's not about the price. The prices are good everywhere. Ski pricing has been very stable over the years. Not many people are going to be tuning their own skis, and the shops are doing work locally. Skiing promotion is primarily local. None of the companies have enough money to get on the map or introduce a new product in any quick amount of time. But the shops getting behind something because they know the product's good, because they know the manufacturer, the distributor is good, and they can really steer people. And that's why you see sometimes it's all about a rep who does a good job getting the skis out there for the consumers in a certain area. There's a lot of good skis. It's all about matching up those skis with the consumer. And I still believe that doing that in person is easier than online.
I've often said in my writings and my weekly revelations that when you're planning to get a new boot, you're not shopping for a boot. You're shopping for a boot fitter. And the boot fitter is going to figure out which boot you need. I think that's true in skis as well. Couldn't we say to the consumer, what you need to do is embrace a specialty shop. Maybe you want more than one. There's no reason you can't have an open relationship with more than one retailer. But I think the more that you work with a given specialist, I think the better the quality of the service they can receive, because they understand you better. And don't you think that we need to get back to good old time relationships, person-to-person relationships instead of online relationships, in order to get the most out of your ski experience?
Well, I think definitely. I think choosing a ski is not, a boot is fairly cut and dry. The graphics, you may be attracted to something, but it's pretty cut and dry. You got a certain type of foot, and most manufacturers have two or three lasts for each model. But skis, it's all over the map. At the U.S. market's height, the most skis sold, there were 220 models. Today, there's 1,200 models. And they're all shapes and sizes, and you don't want to take some of the magic out of it, but it's not so easy to look at a ski wall or look at a website and go right where you need. You need help. You need help for your shape turn, where you're skiing, you know, how steep it is, how fast you go. The manufacturers probably haven't helped themselves because they keep adding models. Obviously, it's more difficult for production, but everybody's afraid to lose a sale. So it's made it quite confusing for consumers. And I think they really do need the help to decide the width of skis they need. You know, I see people skiing in the East, and I've seen magazines have the ski of the year be a 100-millimeter ski, which is absurd. It's absurd. It might be the ski of the year in Jackson Hole, but it's not at Hunter Mountain. And so, you know, the shops can really help make some sense of that. And the ski companies could probably help if they showed a little restraint and had a few less models to make it easier to understand.
Well, model proliferation certainly has been a problem, and it just basically because it confuses the issue. The number of truly great skis, as someone whose business is to try to isolate and identify those skis, it's not a huge number. But the number out there competing for that sale is a huge number. So I think you really have a forest full of opportunities, and you're looking for one tree in this massive forest. And I think you put it very well, Gary. It's a confusing environment in the world of skis. There's a gazillion choices. And yes, it is possible to make the wrong choice. It's possible to think you're putting two and two together and coming up with four, when in fact that's not the correct number, because you buy into either what your friend said or what you think is cool or what you remember the last time you went to a shop, which could have been 10 years ago. So people have a lot of influences on their buying decision. I think my suggestion to you, dear listeners, is make sure part of your circle of advice is a quality specialty shop, and you'll find somebody in there who will champion in your cause and become your ski specialist. I think that's the way to go forward. What do you think about that?
I definitely think out of our members, the staff, the owners are all on the floor. So there's experience there. You're not always talking to a 17-year-old kid who wants to sell you a 106. These shops that we have, the owners are on the floor. Their managers have been with them for years and years. They have a lot of experience. They all go out and demo all the products. We have apps for them to do testing. We can see reviews. And so they really have the experience and the knowledge and put in the time. This is not like talking to a clerk at Macy's. These people are a little more passionate to start with. And if you start looking at the staff in the shops, they've all been with these shops for a long time.
That is really a valuable commodity. Thanks, Gary, for all your insights today. I really appreciate it. And I also want to thank MasterFit Enterprises for helping make this edition of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan possible. And thank you, dear listeners, for your time and your continued support. I'll be back in the airwaves next fall with another season of Real Skiers with Jackson Hogan. Until then, please accept my sincere thanks for listening.